Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time.
When many therapists think about mental illness, they naturally focus on the individual who's struggling. But what about the ripple effects that we know as systemic therapists occur? Meaning, what about those partners who lie awake at night wondering if they said the wrong thing? The parent who's exhausted from walking on eggshells? The spouse who's lost themselves in the process of trying to save someone they love? Today, we're shifting our lens from the identified patient to the family system, exploring how mental illness doesn't just affect one person, but reverberates through relationships in ways that are both profound, sometimes invisible. We're talking about the delicate dance between love and codependency, between support and enabling, between compassion and self-preservation. Our guest today is Dr. Michelle Sherman, whose work has illuminated the complex emotional landscape that family members navigate when a loved one lives with serious mental illness. Michelle brings both clinical expertise and deeply personal insights today to help us understand what it really means to love someone who's struggling with their mental health. Dr. Sherman is a clinical psychologist who has dedicated her 30-plus year career to supporting families dealing with mental illness or a history of trauma. She was named the APA's Family Psychologist of the Year in 2022. She loves public speaking, having given over 250 workshops nationally and internationally. She serves as the editor-in-chief of the journal Couple and Family Psychology Research and Practice. She's published over 75 articles and two books, coupled with her mother, as she will mention today. As systemic therapists, we all know that families are interconnected systems. But how often do we truly address the secondary trauma, the anticipatory grief, the identity confusion that partners and family members experienced when they have a loved one with mental illness? How often do we help them understand that their own emotional responses, whether that be anger, resentment, guilt about the anger and resentment, are not character flaws, but natural human responses to overwhelming situations? Michelle will help us understand today the difference between supportive love and codependency, a distinction that's often blurrier than we'd like to admit. We'll talk about how to help family members manage the marathon of emotions they experience, from the initial crisis mode that can sustain for months, to the gradual realization this might be the new normal, and the ongoing negotiation between hope and acceptance. We'll also dive into the practical side of this systemic work, like how do we help couples maintain intimacy when one partner's mental health creates unpredictability in the daily life of the couple? How do we support family members in developing genuine self-care practices rather than just adding another Ivan to their overwhelming to-do list? And how do we help these caregivers recognize when their own mental health is suffering and needs attention? Perhaps most importantly, we'll explore how we as systemic therapists can create space for the full complexity of what family members experience, including the feelings they're ashamed to admit, the questions they're afraid to ask, and the fears they can sometimes barely voice. Because Michelle's work reminds us, loving someone with mental illness is not a simple act of devotion. It's a complex, ongoing negotiation with uncertainty, loss, and the ability for transformation. And it's our job as systemic therapists not to minimize that complexity, but to honor it, normalize it, and help family members navigate it with greater awareness, compassion, and skill. Let's dive into it with Michelle Sherman. As therapists, you know how common it is for couples or families where alcohol misuse has damaged trust. Even when progress is made in session, that trust can crumble the moment doubt creeps back in at home. SoberLink changes that with discreet, real-time alcohol monitoring, complete with built-in facial recognition and tamper detection. Families get the proof they need to rebuild confidence and move forward. And now, with affordable device rental options, you can introduce SoberLink to clients without the financial barrier. Support lasting change by requesting free client resources delivered straight to your inbox at www.soberlink.com/marriage-counselors. That's www.soberlink.com/marriage-counselors. Eli, back with you. I'm so happy to be joined by Michelle Sherman. And Michelle, we've never done a show on working with significant others, family members with significant mental illness. It's an important topic. But before we get into that, the first question is always, we like to know about the therapeutic origin story, specifically how you got interested in working with family members, supporting other family members suffering from mental illness.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm really honored and happy to be able to have a conversation this morning. I've been a clinical psychologist about 30 years, so I've been doing this sort of work a long time. And honestly, it's an interesting story of how my focus on supporting families began. I was working in a VA outpatient mental health clinic and was just so struck by all the veterans that would go in for their brief med checks, sometimes 10, 15 minutes. And of course, this was way before COVID when things were not virtual. And so all the family members, be it partners, parents, sometimes children, would come and sit in the waiting room. Sometimes they'd accompany their veteran. But there was just such a large number of people just sitting there in the waiting room. And honestly, one day, it just struck me as well. There's such commonality of need, experience, sometimes perhaps confusion, shame, embarrassment, sadness, anger, et cetera. It's like, we have all these people together. Why are we not doing anything to support them? And so literally in the mid-1990s, I wrote my very first baby grant for $3,000 and got money to start developing education curriculum for these families. And so that's where it all began, honestly. I was way back in the mid-1990s and really trying to create and reach out to these families. That has been my passion professionally. I also will share that I have numerous family members, relatives, who live with mental illness. We've had several suicides in my family. And so I am bolstered and driven and passionate, not only by my years doing individual couples, multifamily group therapy for many years, creating and doing research on family issues around mental illness, but absolutely by my own lived experience as a family member who has loved ones living with mental illness as well.
Yes, so well said. The personal and the professional influencing you, as it does for so many of our guests that have devoted their life to a part of this work. Many family therapy models have this idea around psychoeducation around major mental illness. So obviously that is part of the work, but it's also helping those caregivers understand what that's like. So it's more than just psychoeducation about your loved one. It's about your own coping and ability to work through that. So I think our talk today will be useful for clinicians, but also even the general public that has someone very close to them that is suffering with a major mental illness. Let's start by talking about some of the most common misconceptions therapists encounter regarding significant others of individuals with the mental health challenges.
Yeah, one of them is that they don't have any. When I first started this work, people say, oh, they've burned all their bridges. Okay. And certainly some have, absolutely. At times there can be comorbid substance misuse, there can be violence, there can be illegal, difficult behavior. So sometimes it happens, but that is not the norm. If we look, for example, even with emerging first episode psychosis, most people live with their family members in that group and want family involvement. So A, the myth of there aren't family members, B, the myth of families don't want to get involved. That's, again, certainly sometimes, but I'd say the exception rather than the norm. And I'll tell you, see, you'll get to know me, I'm a pretty direct person. Sometimes my psychiatrist, social work, other colleagues say, hey, doc, I've got too many patients myself. I don't have time to deal with these phone calls and these letters and all these other sort of stuff. So they're an additional patient. And while I honor supporting families can absolutely take up more time and energy and things like that, I believe it's actually imperative, because if we don't involve the family system, who has the history, the knowledge, hopefully the relationship, the ability to be an early warning sign, the ability to help affect treatment plans, the most important people in their lives, if we don't engage them, we're missing a huge piece of the puzzle and we're really stymieing ourselves. So that idea of, oh, they're just more of a burden, that's also an obstacle. Certainly the old messages that we as a profession very sadly gave families of, you know, a schizophrenic mother, right? It's your fault. The high expressed emotion, the level of toxicity, criticism, over-involvement, the families are to blame, that old message we gave. We, I believe, as an industry have some repairs to do, to use a clinical term. We have given some messages that have been really unhelpful. And so I believe it's even incumbent upon us even more to lean into validating, seeing, supporting. Even, I'm just at the basic point of sometimes even asking things like, do you have children? How are the children doing? Who else is involved in your life? So I believe that we have made a number of mistakes in terms of inappropriate blame and have some work to redo to catch up from some of that. So those are some of the initial thoughts that come to mind in terms of some of the misconceptions.
Listeners of this show know we talk about the history of MFT a lot, and what you bring up is, oh, so rooted in our history, because without the concept of the schizophrenogenic mother, let's just review for our listeners that this double bind type of communication causes this incongruence that leads to a tipping point in a major mental health episode, specifically schizophrenia in a teenager and emerging adult. So without that theory of the Bateson Project, which lead to the Mental Research Institute, MRI, we wouldn't have what we now know as modern systemic family therapy, schools of strategic things. However, that hypothesis, while it did teach us a lot about communication patterns, obviously is not the truth. And it led to a lot of mother bashing and not a good look, and something that has not aged well, even though it led to the birth of family therapy in many ways. So now we look at things very differently, but the idea of studying the whole family and helping the whole family is one of the things certainly that any MFT believes, expanding the system. And it's interesting because if you have a major mental health episode and you're a teenager, you're still a minor, by necessity, the family is there. You're living with the family. They become more of a part of it. But if this happens in later life, or once you're launched, you're living on your own, it may not be as easy to involve the family, especially if there's guilt and shame or hiding of the diagnosis. I'm curious your thoughts on that as far as age of onset and how that pertains to engaging or helping family members cope with their loved one.
Yeah, such a great question. And it's so varied, as I alluded. I worked in the VA system for about 17 years. And so we'd have a lot of people who would come in after experience trauma, or even honestly, I think of many veterans who are at that time Vietnam era veterans who were then retiring. And that was when some of their symptoms started to come up. So it's not always easy to predict what time developmentally the illness may emerge. Of course, we have norms for psychosis and things earlier and whatever, but things like trauma can happen at any age. And so the family system, of course, is really different if we have this 16-year-old having a first episode versus a 30-year-old perhaps early in the family life cycle, or again, someone who's maybe in their 50s and 60s having some onset of serious mental illness. So the people involved are different, right? So it could be more if it's in their 30s or 50s, a significant other. Again, there could be children or grandchildren involved versus when you're in the family of origin that one you grew up with. So the roles differ, the level of and the ways of involvement differed. When we're talking about biological parents who are raising children, oftentimes, again, there's a lot of that guilt, that responsibility, the loss of hopes and dreams and things of what my loved one will do or could do and all those sorts of those painful things. And often at first, what we see is a huge level of, okay, just let's fix it and let's get the right medication or therapy. It's interesting. I was just 2 weeks ago at a conference in St. Louis presenting to folks who work in first episode programs, particularly with families. And they were saying, yeah, families will really engage at the beginning. And then they'll engage in terms of crisis. But after that, it's hard to keep them engaged, which kind of makes sense, right? Because they have perhaps jobs, other children, relationships, a lot of other things going on. So they maybe hope, okay, you fix the kid, take care of them, and then we'll be able to move forward. So we've got that at that age. And then we've got, when we're looking at the partner, some significantly different dynamics in terms of, is this a relationship I want to continue in? Significant financial implications often if the person with the illness may not be able to continue working. Child rearing, parenting, is this the future I want for us and our family? It really is different in terms of their teeth in the game, in terms of what they want and what'll be the hook. So it's a really interesting reflection question, I think, that you asked. It varies developmentally.
Yeah, and you're hinting at now how the presence of mental illness in one partner typically impacts the couple or the family relationship. What else do we know about that from the research?
Certainly the research shows that we see increased rates of depression and anxiety, certainly some increased rates of ending of the relationship. And if we just think about it, it's, I like to talk about the kind of Dr. Pauline Boss concept of ambiguous loss. This wasn't the person that I knew or that I fell in love with or the person that I'd planned a future with, the emotional unavailability, right? All these sorts of things. It's like, this is truly a loss. And so it can be anger and frustration at the person, at the system. A lot of families I talk to talk a lot about exhaustion. As we know, mental illness can be cyclical. It can be unpredictable. And so dealing with that, oh, is this medication going to work? Or is this therapy going to work? Or if we're in the phase of perhaps them denying they even have an illness, the frustration and the strong desire for them to understand the whole concept that honestly, I just recently learned of anosognosia that I think is important.
Yeah. Tell us about that, because I bet you a lot of our listeners, and I'll be honest, including me, I don't think I've ever heard that term. Tell us.
And again, see, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I didn't hear this until the past 10 years, but I really wanted to learn about it and become aware of it. So it's basically a concept that, such as after one's had a stroke or maybe dementia, they're perhaps not aware of their deficits. It's the same thing with serious mental illness. And the research, particularly schizophrenia, some bipolar disorders, they're saying maybe 40 to 60% of people living with these major mental illnesses maybe have this time. Now, it's not denial. It's not stubbornness. It's not I'm being a jerk sort of thing. It's I simply don't know that I have an illness. This is like normally, yes, the FBI are out in my front patio, and I really am getting special messages from the television. But what research has found is it is the number one predictor of low adherence with treatment, which makes sense, right? Why would I take a medication if I think that I'm fine? And so when I describe this concept of anosognosia to families, they find it so very helpful because it really changes the approach. My families go in with this, we're going to do an intervention and we're going to convince them and we're going to threaten them if they don't do the X, Y, and Z. Gosh, if I don't think I have a problem, that's really not going to work very well. So Dr. Amador has written a book many years ago called I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help. And he draws on his own personal experience of having a brother living with schizophrenia. And he came up with a method called the LEAP, L-E-A-P, the LEAP method, which is a way of communicating with your loved one when they have this anosognosia, this I'm not aware that I'm sick. And so I think it's incumbent upon MFTs, other clinicians, to learn ways of trying to help families understand. Because frankly, if one doesn't, often they do. About half of my current therapy caseload right now is individuals or couples or families in which there's serious mental illness going on. But if we try that, I'm going to convince them, I'm going to force them, I'm just going to beg, borrow, steal, scream, yell. Not only does it not work, it can increase symptoms and harm their relationship. And so we talk about really what's most important. It's that listening, that finding what we do agree on, the partnering, and really emphasizing the relationship is really what prognostically is best for everyone in terms of the family system and the person with the illness.
Yeah, it makes me think of a disorder that is egosyntonic versus egodystonic, meaning your classic access to personality disorders, borderline, narcissistic, like everybody else can see. All the friends, family, loved ones can see, but this person has no awareness. They're the victim or whatever, versus something that's egodystonic, like I have anxiety. I know I'm anxious. I may not know what I'm going to do about it, but at least I know it's a problem. But yes, you're talking about with major mental illness like schizophrenia more, where the person has very little awareness to not only their own level of functioning, but how they're coming off to their loved ones, and trying to hammer that home to them, you're telling us, does not work. Now, let's talk about which is often can be a fine line between helping therapists help their clients differentiate between supportive love for these type of clients and codependency. There's probably a very fine line between the two. How do you help?
You're just nailing it. So important. Because I believe it can be as we teach, yes and right? Not, but it can be both. But it's a juggling act. I think of people I know in my personal life who have loved ones with serious mental illness, and it can be very consuming and take all of your time and energy. And so other relationships are sacrificed. And so that need at times to really be present, but then also at times to really needing to set limits and say, I need to go to my yoga class tonight. I need to go to my church class tonight. Again, maybe just hypothetically, my husband is on the couch, is drinking too much, or is really depressed. I need to struggle with my own guilt and be able to say, yes, I love you. I care about you. And I need to do this for myself. Because if I don't, I'm going to be more resentful of you. I'm not going to want to have sex later. I'm not going to want to be close to you because I need to go fill my own cup. We actually just gave a presentation at a church this past Saturday, a free community event. That part of the theme was information skills and come fill your own cup. And to perhaps preview, one of my key messages I always like to share is that I think it can be very isolating for these family members. And so for them to see and talk to, be it through NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness, be it through DBSA, Depression Bipolar Support Alliance, all sorts of different services, it can be so helpful to talk to other families to feel that they're not alone. And then it's okay to set limits. To try to move away from this codependency that I'm only okay if you're okay. What a message that I said in this talk on Saturday that I just saw families in the audience honestly get tears in their eyes and crying was, it's okay to disappoint your loved ones sometimes. They're like, what? But I think that's true. We need to empower families to be able to, of course, as in their wanting, ready, and desiring to continue to work on their relationship. But it's okay to not be there for them 24/7. You got to find ways to take care of yourself as well. I'm not saying a 2-week trip to the Bahamas, although that might be nice. I'm talking about, again, getting outside and having some time in the vitamin D and the sunshine, even going in your bathroom and taking a bath or stretching or doing something for 5 minutes for calming. It is imperative to be able to set those limits. And I think we may be mentioning that I've recently written with my mother, my co-author, a new book called Loving Someone with a Mental Illness or History of Trauma, Skills, Hope, and strength for your journey. This isn't about what is schizophrenia, what is depression. You can Google that, right? Rather, our books, and this one just came out a couple months ago, published by Johns Hopkins. This is all about skills. It is all about finding ways of supporting your loved one while also taking care of yourself. Again, hope for your journey. And so really, I think it is super important that we find ways that families can balance being supportive, being engaged, yet also doing self-care.
Yeah, let's talk about the book because it has those skills and people, you know, like to listen to a podcast for 45 minutes and leave with some skills. I am curious, the first one you've told about is just blocking out time, giving yourself permission for your own self-care, filling up your cup, as you said. So give us some other skills and then tell us about this process of working with your mom and you as the family psychologist.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, the book, again, it's on Amazon, wherever you can find it. But we have chapters on lots of the skills, frankly, Eli, that I have heard from families in the past 30 years and that I've read and researched and conducted my own research. What do families need? Okay. And part of it are things like limit setting. That's huge. Commitment to self-care, dealing with your own guilt and mixed feelings. I think I'm a person who's pretty honest. And so acknowledging the losses and figuring out what acceptance means to you, holding on to hope. I was talking to a personal friend the other day who was saying, Michelle, I'm not sure I can have hope for my family member. Their family member has quite serious mental illness, but I can hold on to hope for myself, which was cool. There are obviously lots of reasons to be hopeful in the field of mental health, new medications, new therapies, growth of peer support, some decreasing stigma surrounding some condition. There are lots of things that we can be hopeful about, but sometimes it can be hard. So focusing on myself, what I have control over. Obviously, MFTs are bread and butter of teaching communication skills, problem-solving skills, how to navigate the healthcare system. There are a lot of ways in which I think skills that we as mental health providers know and help families with can be really useful for these families. I will also say, however, that I think some of the skills that we learn in graduate school can be, for working with couples and families, can be important to reflect upon in the context of SMI, in the context of really having an understanding of serious mental illness, such as even this anosognosia, because you may try really hard in the family system to try to navigate or get people to understand, and that can backfire. So I think it's really wise for clinicians to take the time and energy, be it these or reading or things like that, to continue to increase our understanding of serious mental illness. In terms of the process of working with my mom, it's a great question. I've honestly been collaborating and writing books for 20 years. So these last two we just published in the last couple months are newer. But the kind of funny story is literally 20 years ago, we were at a family reunion. I said to my mom, hey, do you want to write a book? And she actually lovingly said, anything with you, darling, which of course was a very sweet motherly sort of statement. But neither of us really knew what we were getting into, which was probably a good idea. But the first ones we wrote were for teenagers specifically, one for teens whose parent had mental illness, one for teens whose parent experienced trauma of any kind, and one specifically for military teenagers. We were actually really humbled, and I'll just share this in the context of attesting to the dearth of resources for teenagers, that the National Guard actually picked up our book for teens whose parents experienced trauma and sent boxes to all National Guard units across the country. So that was really very humbling and exciting, but continues to speak to the dearth of resources for teens. So that was in the mid-2000s. Then at the beginning of COVID, I said, hey, Mom, do you want to write another book? And she said, yes. And so we did two things. We wrote this book for adults, the Loving Someone book, and then we did a second edition of the book for teens, I'm Not Alone, a teen's guide to living with a parent who has a mental illness or history of trauma that honestly I am equally passionate about. Incidentally, just last hour, I just got off the phone with a psychiatric nurse in Iceland, and they are translating and using that book in their psychiatric units and things that are just, again, a huge dearth of resources for these teenagers. So that's our writing story. Our collaboration story is actually also a lovely one. And we both say 99% of the time, it's amazing. She is an educator, okay, and has been forever. She is a mental health advocate. And I'm sure the listeners know, writing is hard. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of money. And so we not only kind of lift each other's spirits and encourage one another, but our lived experience helped keep the passion alive and for why we did it. She also would help me if I would write kind of psychobabble stuff, because I tend to write more for professionals. She would help me put it in everyday person's terms. She also helped, and this is extremely important for all of our books, that we write them in engaging, interactive ways. So if you were to look at our book, you would see there are no pages with just text. They all have activities, questions, reflections. We know about the power of writing, right? We know about the power of active engagement with material. And so she would help, as an educator, put things into ways that really the reader could engage with it at multiple levels. So it's been a lovely interaction and process together.
No, what a great personal and professional collaboration. The teenager element is also interesting in the sense that if you have a parent with a major mental illness, the notion to want to protect that many times, also to not become parentified, but to have some semblance of normal life. And I imagine that is very challenging work. What give us a good clinical story, I think, from both perspectives, from maybe a teenager working in combination, as we say, the family therapist, you can see different parts of the systems at different times. So you can work with the teenager alone, you could work with the teenager and the parent, or maybe the non-mentally ill parent, you could work with everyone together. So give us an example a good, powerful clinical story of working with a teenager.
I think MFTs are really in a unique and important position because, just as a meta level for a second before I get into a clinical example, sadly, I think these young people are very invisible. No one asks about them, no one sees them. And so I think MFTs, one of many MFT strengths is really that systemic perspective. And so really being able to see that teenager, I think, is a huge place to go. Because in the families that I work with, oftentimes the parents with the illness and the parent without are so focused on what's going on with them that they don't even have time to think about what is impacting their children, how their children may be experiencing, may be afraid, may be angry. I think of so many families in which young people, teenagers, we'll just use a fictional name, okay? Let's just say Ramon. Ramon doesn't want to have friends over because what if dad's going to be in a manic state or hasn't shaved or showered for days or is going to be aggressive? Why does my mom come to my soccer games and either looks disheveled or is really angry and out of control at the coach or is talking to herself or things like that? Gosh, that's embarrassing. What do I do, again, if Ramon's a little one and my mom won't sit on the ground and play with me? Why won't they be emotionally engaged when they will want to support me in talking about where I'm going to go to college or these sorts of things? In my experience in working with families, it's both the kind of what we call more positive symptoms, the hallucinations, the delusions, these sorts of things, but equally the quote-unquote negative symptoms, the lack of energy, lack of engagement, emotional flattening, unavailability, these sorts of things that can be equally, if not more impactful, in my opinion, for these children and families. And sadly, of course, what we know is children are often going to say, what did I do wrong? What's going on? Why, again, if I'm Ramon, why is my mom always in her bedroom and why won't she come out and engage with us? Or why is she acting in really confusing, strange ways? And so young people like Ramon often blame themselves. And of course, we see some of them really disengaging, and which is developmentally at times normative for them to spend more time with family and friends and things like that. And their peer group becomes more important. But some of them do get into, as you alluded earlier, this kind of caregiver sort of role, that we can see this enmeshment. There's actually been growing work just of late with talking about young people whose parents have serious physical disabilities, less so about the mental, but the physical disabilities. And so you see some of these children responsible for activities of daily living, helping them shower, scheduling doctor appointments, filling their medications, all these sorts of things. The parentification can be huge. And so it's one of the things that we talk with these families about is, okay, yeah, maybe you do have these additional responsibilities for caring for your younger sibling or cleaning or making dinner or things like that. And how else can you be a kid? It's so important, Ramon, for you to be able to be involved in the band at school or hang out with your friends and have other people being able to help you and see you, other systems outside of the family unit, to be able to help Ramon really feel seen such that he, she, they are not confined by that role of being a caregiver. So it's a hard one. I just think MFTs, like I said, have this real distinct skill and ability to see everyone in the family and engage them. And it could be Big Brother, Big Sister program. It could be a pastor, minister. It could be an aunt, an uncle. There are lots of people who can play these roles that MFTs can, I think, engage and to help support the family unit. And again, there may be some times when the parent with illness are doing really well, and so they really don't need that level of support. But during times of crisis and rocky roads, it can be really helpful for MFTs to help broaden that support network.
I think one of the things you said earlier, you were talking about former guest of our show, a legend in the field, Pauline Boss, Ambiguous Loss, this idea that if something happens, the partner that you knew is no longer the same versus if you entered into this relationship. Like in our example, if I'm a teenager, even younger, my parent has always been this way, so this is all I've ever known. Or if you're consciously partnering with someone that you know that has mental illness in a marriage or long-term pair bond is very different than if something happens or they have an episode. And so I think how the relationship, as we were saying earlier, enters is a big variable in how someone adjusts to it. The challenge, back to what you're saying about a physical disability, many times that on the person, people with major mental illness, sometimes they look, and I was talking to a client the other night talking about their significant other. It's like sometimes she's completely normal. She's smart. She's educated. And then other times she is like a different person, a Jekyll and a Hyde effect. So I think that is the challenge. How the course of the mental illness, is it progressive? Is it sometimes acute? So all of these factors, I think, are important in how a significant other or family member adjusts. And if, like we say, in sickness and health in marriage, so if the person is trying to get better, meaning working their plan, doing their therapy, taking their medication if needed, that's very different as far as hanging in there than if a person is like, let's just say they are bipolar, but they like the manic. They like the high highs, so they're not going to take their medication. If a family member that has major mental illness is compliant, I think that is still challenging, but very different experience and certainly more hopeful than if you're trying to help loved ones of a family member that is not compliant, whether they don't even think they have a problem, as we mentioned earlier, or they don't like the side effects of the course of treatment, whether that be a medication or some other avenue trying to help them. I wonder if you could speak on those type of protective factors in doing the work. Then maybe in our remaining moments, we can talk about how to deal with the burnout that and resentment that sometimes comes with these type of relationships.
I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the real potential for burnout. It is huge, which is why I really emphasize the need to, again, fill your own cup and really be able to take that time away, get other people engaged, look at how much responsibility you're taking for your loved one and their mental health. So on that, all that, yes, I totally agree. And on the first point about kind of the ambiguous loss and not really, it's being harder for family members when they're quote unquote either in a synosia or not willing to engage. Here's the message that I like to give families. You know, how many of us every day eat 5 fruits and vegetables, get 150 minutes of aerobic exercise every week, never drive over the speed limit, blah, 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 blah. And most of us probably can't say we do everything perfectly all the time. And I try to instill the sense of being patient, managing whatever condition it is. I actually have some significant autoimmune conditions myself. And the burden of patienthood is a lot. And I actually have a whole part in one of my chapters about reaching out for help is really difficult for lots and lots of reasons. Certainly the shame, the stigma, some spiritual and cultural beliefs or messages, money, insurance, access, schedule. We could go on and on about this. And so if you're, and then side effects, which of course most medications do have some side effects, some which can be considerable in terms of impact on physical health, weight gain, concentration, speaking, et cetera, et cetera. So if your loved one is engaging in care, gee, that's a lot. They're overcoming a lot of barriers and obstacles. And so respecting their choices that if they do or do not want to, for example, go to an intensive outpatient program, a DBT program, take their medications, that is their choice. And there are consequences for their choices. So if they are choosing to not do that and they're acting in symptomatic, whatever sorts of ways, then what sorts of boundaries or limits do you want to set? You know, what is going to be okay and what's not going to be okay for you in terms of managing some of their behaviors? Now, I'm going to make an opinion statement. This is just Michelle Sherman opinion statement, so take it for what it is. I don't believe any mental illness can be an excuse or a rationalization for abuse or violence. That's just Michelle Sherman's opinion, okay? I certainly see it. Family members say, oh, doc, he has schizophrenia, or doc, he has PTSD. That's even a symptom of PTSD, anger, outburst, irritability. We know that. But to me, that doesn't condone or make it okay. So part of it is empowering family members to, yes, perhaps consider what they want to accept. We talk about ACT principles and things like that. What seems reasonable? What do I want to accept? But also figuring out what really is your boundary and what is okay and what's not okay. And finding ways for them to respectfully, kindly, calmly say those and then stick with those sorts of boundaries. Because if they don't in this marathon, not a sprint oftentimes, they're not going to be able to continue and they're going to have a life of meaning and purpose themselves. The other thing I absolutely want to say is, although I mentioned earlier in the anecdote I gave, some people struggle to maintain hope for their family members. Actually, even for things like psychosis, if we look at the research, as opposed to what I was taught and what some family members are still told at first diagnosis of kind of this, you're going to have to be on medications for your whole life. You're not going to be able to work or have a family, you're going to be confined to a life that's very small. That's not the message anymore. We really can have a spirit of hope and a spirit of recovery. Recovery not meaning alcohol and drug recovery, but recovery meaning having a life of meaning and purpose, a belonging, community, using my skills. All people can have that. So let's lean into the hope of recovery. Let's lean into absolutely limit setting. And frankly, the research shows, you know, about 1 out of 3 people with serious psychosis, actually, their symptoms do abate considerably with time. 1 in 3 maybe do have symptoms, but they're able to manage it. And about 1 in 3 may have this more chronic course. So even if we say those numbers, that 2/3 can do a lot better, that instills some hope. So holding on to hope, finding what are appropriate limits, realizing that asking and sticking with help, it can take a lot. It can be really hard. There are a lot of barriers and reasons that it's hard to stay engaged. Again, eating your fruits and vegetables and getting your exercise and all this sort of stuff for any of us, but particularly living with serious mental illness, it can be hard. And so respecting, admiring, appreciating the hard work that it takes to be a loved one living with mental illness. And then to continue, my biggest point here today I'd like to emphasize is the biggest thing is relationship. So is all of our interactions about you have to take your medications, you have to go to the doctor, versus how much can we lean into, hey, you really love bird watching, you really love animals, you really love volunteering, whatever else with elderly. How can we lean into our relationship and build that as well? So we're not just having a conflict and every time we interact, but we have a broader relationship that we can build on during tough times.
Oh, so well said. And I think we talk often on this show about the common factors of good therapy and being able to engender hope. Being a hope merchant, as my friend and mentor Dick Schwartz would call it, is so essential in this work. And I think if you've done this work and you can work with major mental illness and still find a way to do that as a clinician, that is a pretty special common factor in you, and your ability to convey that to the other families you work with is pretty important. You were so articulate this hour. Remind us about the books again, and then please, in the last couple of minutes, any other thing that you think is essential for our listeners to know that maybe you would like to get across, please do that. And then people always like to continue the dialogue. Let our listeners know the best place to do that and to reach you, Michelle.
Oh, awesome. Your questions were just lovely. I love our conversation. So first of all, thank you. The 2 recent books, the one for adults is called Loving Someone with a Mental Illness or History of Trauma, Skills, Hope, and Strength for Your Journey. And that was published by Johns Hopkins and it's available anywhere. And then the one for teens is I'm Not Alone, a teen's guide to living with a parent who has a mental illness or history of trauma. Again, available anywhere. In terms of the final message, in addition to the spirit of hope, to be honest with you, Eli, if MFTs, if other families and clinicians that are listening, if people would consider finding ways to help spread the word of seeing these children, that's my life passion, to be honest with you, Eli. And so I'm even saying, hey, MFTs, the people that you collaborate with, the psychiatry, the providers, the psychologists, whatever else, if you, given your system's expertise, can use your voice to help educate, to empower, even on our clinic intake forms, all these sorts of ways. What are we doing to see these children and what resources are we giving them? Inpatient units, okay? A great place. We've got someone in an imminent crisis. They're a parent. How are we helping them as a parent? We know parenting can be a great reason to get out of bed, to take your medications, to get clean and sober. That is and we know crises are times that families may be more open to resources. So how can we continue to help move the needle, even just 1% for our healthcare system that is, again, so siloed. We got the adults over here, the kids over here. MFTs, again, are great people to merge that. How can we raise awareness to let people know, hey, we got to talk about these kids and their skills we can teach them to promote resilience? We know the research shows about just a recent meta-analysis came out this calendar year, actually, for both major depression and bipolar disorder, the lifetime prevalence of any mental illness among offspring is about 50% for those two. With psychosis, it's interestingly a little bit lower, but these are our next children in our clinic waiting rooms. Let's intervene early. Let's see them. Let's identify them. Let's offer them supports. That is my biggest hope. And so even if one person from our podcast today is willing to think about that or ask some of those questions or even talk about it in staff meetings, hey, what are we doing? How can we support these kids? I would be really delighted.
Yeah, such a great takeaway. And we believe in expanding the system in systemic therapy and MFT anyway. And we also can't ever forget to expand to children who also need supports and help understanding and making sense of the family system that they're growing up in, especially if they have a parent with a major mental illness. Again, the way to contact you, Michelle, give us the best way.
Yeah, the best way is through our website, which is www.seeds with an S, seedsofhopebooks.com. So it's seedsofhopebooks.com. And there's a contact us, and I'd love feedback, reactions. Hey, Michelle, we're doing this. Hey, what do you think about this? Oh my gosh. And literally, honestly, Elif, part of the cool part of this sharing about our books and talking with people is to be learning internationally some other places are doing this and doing much more than folks in the United States are doing. So there are practices out there. There are other people who are doing this stuff. So let's get going. So I would love if people are doing things or want to learn more. I certainly do a lot of public speaking and things. If people want webinars or talking like that, I love to continue to spread the word. Yeah, through our website's the best way to reach me.
Wonderful. Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors. You want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Stay systemic, my friend. Hear the latest debate with our guests and topics we illuminate. From theory to practice, there's so much to know.